Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Look at it this way. It's like the banks are unruly teenagers and Congress is mom and dad.
For heaven's sakes, people, you know, it does seem really ridiculous.
That's Christina Romer. Yes, the banks have gotten in trouble in the past, but mom and dad bailed them out for the sake of the family.
We always did it because that's what had to be done for the American people. No one wanted to bail out the banks just for the bank's sake.
But the banks took the money that was supposed to strengthen the family unit, and they blew it all on themselves.
This big bonus season, of course it's going to offend the American people. It offends me.
Can we send them to their rooms? No dinner? They definitely don't deserve an allowance. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 11th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. And, you know, as a parent, John, we all know no matter how much you yell or threaten, you really can't completely change your kid's behavior.
The unruly banks on a taxpayer's allowance. I like that. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. It's back to work for Congress this week. One of its top priorities will be getting the economy back on track. The president's top economist says more stimulus money is needed to keep the economy moving. But an Associated Press report says spending on roads and bridges under the first stimulus plan has had no effect on local employment.
The bank bonus season gets underway today on Wall Street. Goldman Sachs is expected to pay its employees an average of nearly $600,000, with many bankers throughout Wall Street getting six, seven, even eight-figure bonuses. Former New York Governor Elliot Spitzer shares his thoughts on that with CBS News.
This is inequitable, it is wrong, it is aberrant, and it's creating a crisis.
For more, we're joined now by Eric Dash. He's a banking reporter for the New York Times. Good morning, Eric.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so we just heard about some of the top bonuses. Give me an average bank bonus if I were one of these upper executives.
Yeah, we're probably going to see some big sticker shock. Probably upwards of several $1 million for some of the top executives, an average at some of the big banks that really performed well of several $100,000 a year.
Okay, so do you have to pay, do you really have to pay an executive a bonus to keep them there?
You know, the banks argue they do, and it's really a tale of two banking stories here. You have profitable banks like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan saying, look, we earned this money fair and square. And then you have banks that didn't earn money or lost money, in fact, saying, look, we need to pay what the big guys are paying, too, because we're going to lose our people.
Okay, we'll get more into those details in a moment with Eric Dash. We'll be back with you.
A controversy in Washington over remarks by Harry Reid quoted in a new book saying that Barack Obama could be president because he was, quote, light-skinned and didn't have a Negro dialect unless he wanted one. The Republican leader, Michael Steele, has called for his resignation. Harry Reid, the majority leader in the Senate, says he's apologized for the remarks and has no intention of resigning. Here in New York City, opening arguments get underway this afternoon in the first prosecution of a Guantanamo Bay prisoner in a U.S. civilian court.
And in California, the first federal trial to determine if same-sex marriages are legal under the Constitution gets underway today. It's a challenge to Prop 8, the gay marriage ban that was approved by California voters. Meanwhile, in Northern California, residents dodged a bullet when a 6.5-level earthquake hit yesterday. It was centered 22 miles offshore with only minor damage. In the markets, futures are up right now. The Dow gets underway at 10,618. The S&P opens at 1,144. And the NASDAQ will start at 2,317.
Coming up in the show, Family Life on Monday. We're going to talk about shared parenting and the challenges of that. But we're also talking about that Harry Reid story I referred to a moment ago. How seriously are you taking this comment that Harry Reid was quoted as saying about President Obama? The president has accepted Reid's apology, but the GOP is saying he should step down. What do you think?
Hello, my name is Jackie. I'm calling from Queens, New York. And I think, you know, it was meant to be derogatory, and I think that's how it was a racial issue. And it's what most, I think, people think.
Tell us what you think at 800-543-2543. That's our number just for today. 800-543-2543. Or email us, as usual, at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Wall Street's big paydays.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Two hot issues and one brand new phone number for you to reach us. We want to reiterate that number for you. It's 800-543-2543, 800-543-2543. To weigh in on Harry Reid being quoted as saying that President Obama might have been electable because he was a light-skinned African-American and had no Negro dialect. Also, weigh in on what kind of bonuses do you think Wall Street bankers deserve or not. You know how to reach us, 800-543-2543.
Speaking of bonuses, it's funny you should bring that up, because this very week is when workers on Wall Street are going to find out what kind of bonuses they're getting. Sometimes these bonuses are 80% or more of what they're getting in salary. Many of these banks, Eric Dash was telling us earlier, even those that are losing money are planning to pay out huge bonuses that equal, in some cases exceed, what we saw before the banking crisis. We're joined again by Eric Dash, reporter for the New York Times. Good morning, Eric.
It's great to be here again.
So give me the details on these bonuses. What's the bottom end and the high end? Who's paying what?
So the sums are pretty staggering no matter where you look. At some of the big banks that lost money, it's probably the average or in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And at some of the big banks that made money, could be upwards of several hundred thousand dollars. And for the top executive suite guys, several million dollars apiece at least.
Now, if the point is to reward, if a bonus is supposed to reward someone for a job well done, how does a bank that is losing money justify giving a bonus?
Well, they say that everyone else is paying that money too. So if we don't give our employees money, we're going to lose them. We need to keep the best and brightest to keep us and nurse us back to health.
Okay, so let's listen to one of our listeners, what they had to say about this.
Why don't these people take a salary like the rest of the world? I don't get a bonus. And the people that should be getting paid these bonuses are doctors, nurses, social workers, teachers, not the finance people.
We're not talking about people whose salary is low. They have generous salaries, do they not?
Not by normal standards. They do have generous salaries. But in the warped world of Wall Street, they say, look, as a percentage of our overall compensation, our salary is pretty low.
Okay, well, the warped world of Wall Street is the subject that Dan Ariely studies. He's the James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University, author of Predictably Irrational. Dan, good morning.
Good morning.
In the warped world of Wall Street, do you think that we should be having a further conversation about bonuses? Should we be changing the structure so that bonuses are not necessary in order to attract people?
So I think the discussion really has kind of two parts. The first one is how much money we should pay people on Wall Street. And then the question is, how should we divide that between a fixed salary and a bonus? And I think the discussion is kind of mixing those two. So the first thing is, how much should we pay them? How much do these people get paid in general, regardless of the method of payments, you know, stocks, bonuses, fixed salary? And I think this is the first kind of difficult part. Before the recession, we thought that they had particular amazing skill. We thought these were people that knew something that the rest of the world didn't. They were super special, able. You know, they got the market to go up for about 20 years. And because they were so good and so talented, they deserve a lot of money. And the recession basically showed us that they were not that talented. They didn't know that much. In fact, there were lots of things that they didn't understand at all. And all of a sudden, we're revisiting our understanding of how much skill is really involved in being a Wall Street person in general. I'm not saying that there are few people who have tremendous skill, but in general, when we think about the big size. The second thing is we believed in the market. We believed that the market was going to price things correctly, that stocks are going to be priced correctly, the bonds are going to be priced correctly because of the pressure of the market. And we also thought that salaries are going to be priced correctly because of the pressure of the market. But all of a sudden, our realization that the market is not rational, that the stock market is not working as it should be, makes us also wonder whether the salary market is not working as it should be. And we understand the problems of conflict of interest. In reality, what happens is you have lots of people who can get paid a lot of money, and they control their own salary, and they give themselves very high salary. I mean, think about it, Celeste. What would happen if you were in charge of salaries of radio broadcasters? I mean, wouldn't the salary structure change within the radio station?
Well, mine would. I don't know about John's.
How about John's? Not so much, huh?
well, here's the thing, Eric, that the banks are arguing that because the economy has recovered, because the banks have recovered, that they don't, A, they don't do not need banking reform, and that the rest of the country doesn't need to get their nose into what they're paying their employees.
Right. And that's the real tragedy of this. We had a crisis. Rahm Emanuel says, you know, look, never lose the opportunity to waste a crisis. And yet it seems like we are, because the farther we get away, the banks now have paid back the TARP money that they took. The pays are, he's almost powerless over the Wall Street firms. And the farther we get away and farther we get back to normal, the less we have at a chance of real reform, I think.
Dan Ariely, on Tuesday they're going to start this financial crisis inquiry, but that's just looking into how this crisis began. They're not going to be talking about reforms. Have we lost the opportunity for reform?
I think absolutely we've lost some of it. And, you know, what I think the people on Wall Street don't understand or don't appreciate or don't at least admit is that we haven't really recovered. You know, we have this artificial recovery right now that is due to the incredible injection of public money into the banking world. And the fact that it looks like there's a recovery is basically people in Wall Street taking away tax money. Now, I'm not saying that every bank is taking directly, but the reason that the market is doing relatively so well compared to the rest of the economy is because we've injected, we've kind of, you know, sold our future and injected lots and lots of money into this situation. I do want to mention one more point, which I think is important, which is the question of how much do we pay in bonuses? You know, and we've done some studies, I think, John, I told him about this before, in which we ask the question of, do people perform better when we give them high bonuses? I mean, part of the logic is saying that we want to give people big bonuses because we want them to really perform well. We want them to be wonderful performers. And the question is this really the case? And as a thought experiment, you can ask yourself whether if you are going to have, let's say, a heart surgery, whether the moment before the operation you want to tell your physician, you know what, if you'll do this well, I'll pay you $1 million. Will you think that the physician, while operating on you, thinking about their bonus, will actually perform better?
But I think it's more than just being about big bonuses. I think it's not about paper performance. It's about the size of the zeros.
That's right.
And that people are just mad.
People are definitely mad. That's Eric Dash, banking reporter for The New York Times. Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University, author of Predictably Irrational. It's 15 minutes now. Let's take a look at the headlines.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton takes off today on a 10-day trip to strengthen ties with allies in the Pacific. She'll visit Australia, New Zealand, and Papua New Guinea and stop briefly in Hawaii to meet Japanese officials. Mixed news out of Afghanistan today. NATO says 3 U.S. service members were killed in the latest fighting, but an opinion poll commissioned by the BBC found that people are feeling better about their lives in Afghanistan. Some 1,500 people were interviewed across the country in December. 70% said they felt Afghanistan was heading in the right direction, significantly more than a year ago.
Back at home in California, the first federal trial to determine if same-sex marriage is legal under the Constitution gets underway today. It's a challenge to Prop 8, that's the gay marriage ban approved by California voters. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Kenji Yoshino, a law professor at New York University, who told us the case against the ban has two main arguments.
The liberty argument says that there's a fundamental right to marry, and the equality argument says that this is discrimination against gay people.
The stimulus spending on roads and bridges has done little to improve local employment. That's what an analysis by the Associated Press finds, as reviewed by independent economists at 5 universities. And Israel says it'll build a barrier along 2 stretches of its border with Egypt to keep out illegal migrants and militants. Thousands of economic migrants and refugees have crossed into Israel in recent years. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're going to talk about the very painful job losses around the country from the past 2 years. Is it a bad job picture right now? Are we still losing jobs, and what does that mean? We'll talk about it in a minute.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now it's time for some takeouts on news that we're following this week. And in a new book, it is reported that Senator Harry Reid said Barack Obama could become the first black president because he has light skin and has, quote, no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. For more on how this is playing out in Washington, we're joined now by the Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
Here's Dianne Feinstein's response to this crisis.
All of us are imperfect. Clearly, this was a mistake. Clearly, the leader misspoke. He has also apologized.
Okay, so Todd, he misspoke and he already apologized, so there will be no political fallout for the Democrats now.
Well, I don't know about no political fallout. It's too early to tell, of course, but Dianne Feinstein was the only Democrat, I think, to appear on national television on the Sunday shows this morning, and I guess she only has one wagon, Celeste, but she did circle it around Harry Reid. I did get in touch with some high-ranking Democratic officials from the Senate over the weekend, and their consensus seems to be that passing health care right now is the priority, and no one wants anything to get in the way of that. They also all said, and it's possible they've all agreed to say this, but that Harry Reid has earned a certain amount of respect on racial issues, and that this comment, while stupid, while unfortunate, poorly chosen words, nobody is really doubting Harry Reid's views on race. So at least in the halls of the Senate so far, there doesn't seem to be a lot of fallout for Harry Reid's leadership. You know, weeks can pass and we'll see what really happens, but everybody really thinks that passing the health care reform bill, as complicated as it is politically, is the priority, that if that doesn't pass, it's a disaster for Democrats. So they don't want to let a leadership crisis get in the way of that.
But could we get to the point where Michael Steele, chairman of the GOP, drums up enough resentment that Harry Reid would have to step down?
Sure, you can get to that point, absolutely. You know, Michael Steele calling for Harry Reid's resignation yesterday, I think, was playbook politics. You would expect the Republican chairman of the RNC, an African-American himself, to call for that. I don't think that was much of a surprise. You know, Harry Reid is a little bit lucky, as bad as these remarks may have been, I think he's a little bit lucky, A, that he didn't say it in front of a television camera. He said it in a book. And B, that senators are out of town. They're still on break. The Senate really functions on relationships when senators get together in a room, and they won't do that at all until next week, ironically, after the observance of the Martin Luther King holiday. I think it'll be interesting to see how the Senate observes that day, given these remarks. But senators are out of town. They're separated. And so far, no one is calling for Harry Reid's head. So that's good news for him.
Okay. Thanks so much, Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent.
Our next takeout comes from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor, who, and I'm going to throw you a curve, Ibrahim, right at the top. Were you surprised to learn that you're more likely to be president if you're a light-skinned African-American with no Negro dialect?
Coming from Brooklyn, I'm definitely not likely to be president.
Yeah, you're disqualified if it's Brooklyn, that's for sure. Well, it was a wild card weekend in the NFL. Both Saturday and Sunday had games, and the late game last night was the Cardinals against the Green Bay Packers.
Shotgun snap, Rodgers dropping back, in trouble, Rodgers hit, ball came out, Cardinals have it, Dansby, he's going to score,
no.
Cardinals win, they're going to New Orleans!
And that was it, the final play. The Cardinals won 51-45 in overtime. Why did the Cardinals just sort of like win in an instant like that?
Well, this brings up an interesting, applying pressure to the quarterback makes wide receivers scramble as they try and get open, and offensive tackles grab and scrape guys and potentially get a hold, and it also makes quarterbacks make bad decisions. In the first play of the game, Aaron Rodgers scrambled to get open, scrambled out of the pocket, and he threw an errant pass, and he got an interception. That play was similar to this play. Pressure came from the Cardinals' defense. It crushed in on Aaron Rodgers, and he made a mistake. He let the ball fumble out, and that's when Michael Adams hit him, and then Carlos Dansby just scooped it up and did what he's supposed to do.
No margin for error in overtime. It's sudden death when he crossed that line into the end zone. That was the end.
It's true, and it was the highest scoring game in NFL history.
In playoff history, 51-45.
It was a shootout.
Speaking of shootouts, it was a humiliation of the Patriots, the New England Patriots.
That was the end of an era. You know, you want to talk about the New England Patriots and Tom Brady being this perfect and flawless quarterback, but he looked pretty weak. His balls were like flopping all over, end over end. He didn't look like the sharpshooter that we know him to be.
And the Baltimore Ravens scored twice early, and the question is, can they match up against the Indianapolis Colts in their game next week?
The way that their running game is playing and the way that their defense is playing, their running game keeps the pressure off of their defense, and it makes them a really difficult team to play at this point in time. Ray Rice, the Rutgers product, he's playing amazing as a running back. He's playing amazing football.
And Favre plays the Dallas Cowboys, perhaps the hottest team in the NFL right now.
That will be a defensive game. Watch.
Right. America's team versus a legend. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much.
Our next takeout is a weather takeout, and if you have stepped outside and you're in the eastern seaboard somewhere, you know it's been cold, especially down south and in Florida. It's affecting crops, it's affecting wildlife. And Robert Ortovec is here from the National Weather Service to explain what's going on. Robert, we are definitely into uncommon territory right now, right?
Yeah, it's been very cold across a good part of the country. And one thing that's really stood out about this cold pattern is it's been very persistent. We've had a persistent flow out of the north and northwest across at least the eastern two-thirds of the country. And whenever we have the flow out of the northwest, we keep the flow from coming off the ocean. And when the flow comes off the ocean, we generally have milder temperatures across the United States. But right now, the flow has been mostly out of the northwest. We've had persistent cold weather. It's been relatively cold or below average temperatures now for several weeks, starting out in the middle or later part of December and continuing now into the first few weeks of January.
So when is it going to warm up?
Well, actually, it looks like we're going to have a pretty significant pattern change across the continental U.S. in that the winds will be coming more out of the west, from west to east. And when they blow from west to east, they come more off the ocean. And since the ocean covers most of the world, whenever the wind blows more from the ocean, it has a much more great moderating effect, especially on our temperatures. So it looks like the stretch of very cold temperatures is coming to an end. And actually, this morning, temperatures across the northern plains, which have been well below zero over the past week or so, are relatively mild. They're above zero.
Lots of detail about the weather. Robert Ortovec, meteorologist in the National Weather Service, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Coming up, we're going to set the agenda for the week on this Monday morning. But right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. NATO says three U.S. soldiers have been killed in fighting in southern Afghanistan. That raises the number of U.S. military deaths to 10 so far this year. Opening arguments this afternoon in the first prosecution of a Guantanamo Bay prisoner in a U.S. civilian court. The judge must first decide if the prisoner's rights were violated when he was held for 5 years without charges.
A new USA Today poll out this morning shows Americans wouldn't mind going through body scanners at airports if it meant stopping a terrorist attack. In the poll, nearly 80% say they'd have no problem going through the scanners, which shows the body's contours in detail. Heineken is reportedly buying the beer operations of one of Mexico's biggest brewers. The $8 billion deal by the Dutch beer maker would give them ownership of brands like Dos Equis and Tecate. We'll have more on that later in the show. And you've probably noticed the price of gas going up at your gas station. A nationwide survey found gas prices have jumped 14 cents over the past few weeks, once again working their way toward the $3 mark. Truby Lundberg, who conducted the survey, says the average price now stands at $2.74.
The current price is the highest since late October 08, and it's 96 cents above its year-ago level.
And they've handed out the awards this morning at the Detroit Auto Show. The Ford Fusion Hybrid wins the 2010 North American Car of the Year, while the Ford Transit Connect takes Truck of the Year. 49 auto journalists make the picks. Time now for a check on the markets. Futures are up. The Dow will get underway at 10,618. The S&P opens at 1,144, and the NASDAQ starts at 2,317. Gold has jumped more than $5 to 1,139. Those are some of the stories you're following this morning.
Clean energy,
healthcare,
growing our economy,
terrorism in the world today,
putting our people back to work,
no fly list,
doing the work that needs to be done.
So it's Monday morning, which is when we check on the week's agenda. And earlier this morning, we spoke with Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and also Rob Watson, correspondent for our partner, the BBC. And we asked Marcus Mabry if President Obama could maintain this crisis management stance that he adopted all last week in the wake of the fallout from the attempted Christmas Day bombing of a Detroit-bound flight.
Well, you know, I think you've got no choice but to try to maintain it. The problem is going to be, it was a lapse. We don't have good answers, number one, of why it happened in the end, and number two, of how we're going to prevent it next time. So he can try to do it. I don't think he was that successful last week. I think you have no choice but to try to do it again this week to maintain that same posture. Otherwise, you give in to exactly what happened to the George Bush administration with Hurricane Katrina, the sense of incompetence, and that sets in and that really wrecks the rest of your agenda.
Rob Watson, your colleague Jonathan Marcus last week said it's all pragmatism, pragmatism, pragmatism on the part of the Obama administration. It seems like that's what we saw last week. Does it continue this week?
I guess so. I would come at this from the point of view of how the punters see it, ordinary folks see it. And I think no matter how you try to spin, manage, whatever word you like to use, the punters just tend to think, well, there's been a screw-up. And I think whoever's in office, I think they see things in pretty black and white terms like that. Now, that said, I think the punters, the people, also seem to understand that preventing terrorist attacks, whether in the United States or anywhere else, is not a straightforward or easy matter.
And speaking of things that aren't straightforward or easy, North Korea is now calling for peace talks with the United States. This morning, we learned that Pyongyang possibly could return to talks on its nuclear disarmament in exchange for a peace treaty with the U.S. and an end to sanctions. Is this real progress, and did the Obama administration do anything to motivate this?
Well, I think the Obama administration and the South Koreans are going to have a bit of a sigh and groan about this, because I think it'll be seen in Washington and Seoul as yet more dithering and dickering about by the North Koreans, because what the United States and South Korea want is for the six-party talks to get back and focus on what they're supposed to be about primarily in the first instance, which is North Korea's nuclear ambitions. Now, to suddenly have to throw in the complexity of trying to negotiate a peace treaty, I think will be most unwelcome in D.C. and in Seoul.
All right. Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, set us up on this story a little earlier in the hour. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, is quoted in a new book called Game Change, and the quote may change the game for Harry Reid. Reid said, according to the quote, that Barack Obama might become the nation's first black president, speaking back during the campaign, because of his light skin and that he has no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. Where does this issue go this week, Marcus Mabry?
Well, you know, the Republicans are going to keep hammering on this. This is, for the Republicans, a fortunate and some might even say amusing, perhaps, role reversal, because they get to actually say the Democrats are racist and we're going to defend, African-Americans. And happening to have, for the first time ever, an African-American head of the Republican National Committee kind of plays into that script. I don't think they get a lot of political mileage out of this. I think they will try to do it this week. But I think the Democrats are going to work really hard this week to make this week about there. You know, they have an issues conference on Thursday, at the end of the week, where the Democrats get together and talk about what they want to do in the House of Representatives in this session. And I think the Democrats are going to try to make it about jobs, because they realize if they don't do that, then they won't have any jobs come November this year.
Right. And, you mentioned Michael Steele, the Republican Party chairman, the GOP, the head of the RNC. Listen to him talking yesterday, and then we'll play DNC chairman Governor Tim Kaine and listen to them both referring to Harry Reid's remarks. First, Michael Steele.
From my perspective, whether he steps down today or I retire him in November, either way, he will not be the leader in 2011.
I don't think this is an issue that's going to affect his leadership at all. In fact, he's doing some very heavy lifting, wonderful lifting right now to get this health care bill over the goal line.
Wonderful lifting, Marcus. So the conversations at that Democratic retreat will be all about health care, or is there going to be some sense that, Harry Reid's in trouble? Sorry, we can't save him. Maybe there are people who would be happy to have him go.
You know, I think there are certainly a lot of more liberal Democrats who would be happy to see him go. But I don't think we're going to see that this week. I think they're going to try to pivot quickly from health care. They're trying to hammer out a deal and the details of it between the House and Senate versions of health care reform behind closed doors. They actually don't want to do that in a regular conference committee. They don't want it to be too transparent. They don't want to give the Republicans too much of a chance to intervene in that process and slow it down. So they want to get that done actually before the State of the Union so that they can just, again, turn to the issue of jobs. Because they realize with those disappointing job numbers from last week, that's what Americans are going to be concentrating on like a laser beam.
Well, two other issues before we go. First, the federal court's going to hear a suit filed by gay marriage advocates challenging Proposition 8 in California. Is this headed to the Supreme Court, Marcus Mabry?
Inevitably, yes. It's going to be an amazing, unprecedented trial we're going to see where we talk really about the rights of an American minority in a way that we haven't done it before in a very public, open session in federal court.
All right, then, Rob Watson, some positive news, according to the BBC, conducting a poll in Afghanistan. Positive news for the Obama-Afghan policy. What do you think, Rob?
It is hugely positive, and I'll make this brief, but the headlines on it are really staggering. It basically shows there's a lot more support for President Karzai. Support for the Taliban has absolutely plummeted, and there's a real softening, a real brightening of attitudes towards US and other foreign forces being there. Hugely, hugely encouraging for the Western intervention in Afghanistan.
Encouraging results from a poll conducted by ABC News and the BBC just out this morning. Joining us earlier this morning, Rob Watson, our BBC partner, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. There's your agenda. Coming up, who does more of the parenting in your house? We talk family life every Monday and whether parenting can truly be equal.
This is Mark calling from Massachusetts. I am a stay-at-home dad. I cook every meal that we eat. I do the laundry. I make the beds. I clean. I dust. I do the dishes. And I get the children ready for school. I'm home when they get home from school. I help them with their homework. My wife works, has a hell of a job, does a great job, and she deserves to come home and relax, and I let her do that.
Sorry, ladies, apparently he's taken. Tell us your story at 800-543-2543. We'll talk more later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. You may not have known this, but yesterday was a holiday of sorts. It was No Pants Day.
That was yesterday. I forgot.
Yeah, you
oh,
totally
I
missed it.
I completely forgot.
16 countries, 44 cities participated with thousands of people taking their pants off to ride the subway.
Oh, no wonder people looked at me ridiculously this morning.
Alex Cordellis, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Celeste and John. How are you?
Good. You are from Improv Everywhere. That's the group that started this, and you led a group of 3,000 pantless people on the subway yesterday, correct?
Yes, we did. It was quite a group.
The no-pants subway ride. You have to tell me right away, they did have underwear on, right?
They had underwear on. That's the joke, is we board the subway with our pants on, and one at a time we take our pants off and sort of get reactions of shock and surprise from other passengers on the subway who were pretty surprised to see that happen.
Okay, so is the shock what you're going for? Is the point of this prank the surprise on people's faces?
I think more to make people laugh and give people a story to tell. I was sitting next to four young men who were just kept saying, "I got to call my mom and tell her about this." And so give them a story to tell, I think. It's not something you see every day, to see a subway car full of people without their pants on.
I think what surprises me is that this is in 16 countries, people that have this lingering desire to get under the subway and remove their pants.
It is. It's been spreading. This is the ninth year we've done this, and it started with just eight guys in their boxer shorts, but now we have people in Buenos Aires, Argentina, doing it, and people in Vienna, Austria. And I mean, in Argentina, they complained about it being hot because it was 88 degrees. So it's a little bit of a different situation than New York, where it was, I think, 28 degrees here yesterday.
Alex,
it definitely has spread.
Could I just ask a personal question, Alex, just for a second? Where on your resume, close to the top or the bottom, does it say founder of No Pants Day? Is that something you put right at the top?
I'm just a senior agent in Improv. I'm not the founder, but it is close to the top. Actually, I'd say it's number one.
Well, and you must have to be pretty careful about your underwear and boxer shorts selection on that day.
Yes, a lot of planning goes into it, testing out different pairs in front of the mirror. It's a process.
Deciding whether different colors make a statement or whether you should wear the one that has the little racer cars.
Exactly. So, yeah, a lot of decisions have to be made.
So has there been negative reaction from people when you pull your pants off? Do people tell you to put your pants back on?
This year, the reaction was 100% positive. Back in 2006 in New York City, a police officer did stop the subway train. He had no idea what was going on, and he ended up handcuffing a few people. And ironically, the officer who did the handcuffing back in 2006, his name was Officer Panton. No joke. But since then, we haven't had any problems. And there were no charges when that happened. There's nothing illegal about wearing boxer shorts or underwear in public in New York City.
Okay, so all across the world, actually, from Zurich to Australia to Argentina and Spain, people are taking off their pants. How did you spread the word to people to remove their pants on the subway or the train?
The ball's sort of gone rolling on its own. We have posted videos online over the years of our No Pants Day in New York, and people around the world and all these cities have thought it sounds like a pretty good idea. Now it's, like you said, 44 cities and 16 countries, and the word is spreading.
With sponsor by Levi Strauss.
Sponsor free.
So,
through the loom.
Alex Scardellis, he led a group of 3,000 people onto the subway yesterday where they all removed their pants for International Pants Day, which you missed this year, John. You
International No Pants Day.
Oh, did I say
International
Pants Day?
Pants Day.
Well,
every
you have
day.
The pants, and then yeah. you have the no pants. Right. So first it's International Pants Day, and then...
It's every day.
Every day, right.
Let's hope.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry, and it's a sad truth that women do most of the housework around the house, and they also do most of the child rearing, and it's been the same since the days of our grandparents. We're going to talk about how to maybe change that in just a few moments. We're also talking about what Harry Reid had to say. How seriously do you take his comment that President Barack Obama was able to become the first black president because of his lighter skin and the fact that he didn't have a Negro dialect?
Opal Ritchie calling from Detroit. As awkward as and unfortunate his statement was, and it was just a clumsy statement, he said what everybody else is thinking. Now, come on, people. Would you really vote for Al Sharpton? Come on.
Give us your take, 800-543-2543, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The 111th Congress gets back to work this week. The economy's high up its priority list. The president's top economist, Christina Romer, told ABC News more stimulus money is needed to keep the economy moving. But an Associated Press report this morning says the first stimulus package had no effect on local employment. And the tough work on a final health care bill resumes today with congressional Democrats split on how to pay for it. President Obama meets with labor leaders who are angry with his support of a tax on high-end insurance plans rather than a tax on millionaires.
Supreme Court expected to weigh in on campaign finance issues this week. It could potentially allow businesses, unions, and wealthy individuals to pay for campaign ads without limits. We're looking at international business now with our partner, the BBC. We're taking a look at Heineken, which has announced it will buy the brewing operations of FEMSA, one of Mexico's largest brewers. FEMSA is the maker of Dos Equis, Tecate, and Sol Brands beer. It's been acquired by the Dutch brewer in a $7.6 billion deal. Earlier this morning, I spoke with Andrew Walker, the BBC's economics correspondent in London, and I asked him what the consolidation of the brewing industry means for all these Mexican brands.
Well, it leaves them part of a very big group indeed. Heineken already claims to be number two in the world by revenues. This deal will consolidate that position. It's certainly a very important deal for Heineken. There are some important brands. I have to say, as someone who conforms to my national stereotype of preferring warm English bitter, I had to scratch my head a little bit when I started reading the release from Heineken this morning. But it is an enormously important market for them. They reckon Mexico and Brazil, and FEMSA has some interest in Brazil as well, are respectively fourth and second biggest beer markets in the world, after the United States. So, you know, a really big deal for Heineken.
And from here on out, it's the Danes versus the Belgians, right, in the brewing business? Or the Dutch versus the Belgians.
There's them, yes, and there's also SAB Miller, the South Africans. So this is the big trend in the brewing business is undoubtedly one of consolidation. Increasingly big international players who can get the advantages of distribution and production on a very, very large scale indeed. Now, it doesn't mean there's no room at all for the small specialist breweries. You've got plenty of those in the States. We have them here too. But, you know, just as long as consumers are willing to pay a premium price for their beers.
And Heineken will pay $7.6 billion to acquire FEMSA, the Mexican largest brewer there. Our international business look comes from Andrew Walker, BBC economics correspondent who joined us from London. Thank you, Andrew.
Pull out of the shadows and find that eventually there we are and what we are is still family.
After spending a weekend at home with your family, we always figure Monday's a good time to talk about family issues here on The Takeaway. Today we're talking about parenting duties and who does more of them. We have a pretty good answer from surveys. We're also joined by our Motherload blogger and Takeaway family contributor, Lisa Belkin. She's been thinking about this for a while. And Lisa, you know, reading through all of the different surveys, reading through all the research, it basically narrows down to the fact that women do pretty much twice as much work at home overall, in general, of all the work. And that stayed the same for a very long time.
Well, that's just housework. When you look at childcare, it's 3-1. And yeah, the numbers have been the same for about 90 years. Not the number of hours that we work, but the ratio of men to women. And it's the same whether he works and she stays home, whether they both work. And interestingly, it's about 2-1 for housework if she works and he stays home. So we're locked into
If he's staying home, she's still doing twice as much housework?
She's still doing close to twice as much housework.
Okay.
And, you know, couples are looking at each other and saying, how did we get here? We're progressive and we're educated and this, we didn't expect we'd turn into our parents. And yet we're surprisingly like our parents, and actually we're surprisingly like our grandparents our ratios.
Right, 90 years ago. So we're joined now by Amy and Mark Vachon. They're authors of the book Equally Shared Parenting. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So you were so concerned about this that I understand you actually talked about equally shared parenting on your first date.
Well, there wasn't a term for it back when we first started dating, but we did talk about what we wanted our lives to look like. We're like many young single people who say that they want an egalitarian relationship and balanced lives, and we didn't know how to create it any more than the next couple. But we were determined to not live out the lives that Lisa just described of our parents and our grandparents. We wanted things to be different. So we were pretty determined in trying to find a way to do that.
So how do you do it? Do you actually sit there and keep a notebook tally of every single chore that each of you is doing?
That's actually a myth we'd love to clarify. No, no, and no. It comes from getting below the surface of this issue, getting below who's going to do more and tit for tat and all that stuff, to what do we both want from life together as a parenting pair. So we each brought one piece of what we then discovered were the two goals of this lifestyle. And in interviewing many other couples for our book, we've discovered that those goals kind of fit for all of them. And that is that they both want an equal partnership. Someone to walk together through life. We're all walking in each other's shoes, and there's an intimacy to that. And we want to preserve a balanced life for each partner, which is hard to do when, say, a man gets stuck into the breadwinning role and misses out on, you know, perhaps some time he would rather have with his children, or a woman gets stuck juggling it all. And so those greater goals are really what sustain us and a lot of other equally shared parenting couples when it gets down to structuring their lives to then end up doing about the same amount of work in the home and about the same amount of work caring for their children and get the joys of those domains as well.
Okay, but Lisa, this gets complicated by the fact that we also know from research that there's a perception among men that they're doing half the work even though they're not. So how do you do this? Exactly what do you do to make sure that the chores are shared equally?
Well, this only works, I think, if he is fully on board. Because, yes, there is this tendency to say, well, look at me. Men compare themselves to their fathers and say, look how great I'm doing. Women compare themselves to their mothers and feel like they're falling short. It takes the kind of conversation that Mark and Amy have regularly. You mentioned the strict division, and whenever I write about them, and I have a number of times now, that's the reader response, is this is too stringent, this is too much drawing up of lists, this is too much structure, I can't do this. And yet when you're with Mark and Amy, which I've had the pleasure of doing, they are just, they're content, they're laid back. Hmm. There's neither of them is in charge of the other one in the way that's become too familiar for some couples. He does it wrong, for instance. They don't do that.
Amy and Mark, that's a lot of pressure. I mean, if you guys get divorced, Lisa Belkin's out of business, huh?
I think she can rest assured. We're okay.
And this, Amy, Mark, does this work no matter what your job is, whether you're a corporate executive or if you're working at Starbucks?
Well, we've interviewed dozens of couples, and exactly, we've had couples who are baristas at Starbucks, and we have house painters and doctors and lawyers and pretty much the whole spectrum of careers. I would like to say clearly that I would not have signed up for this lifestyle if in an attempt to try to get more dishes thrown my way. I mean, that's not the goal here. My goal is to have a happy life where both Amy and I can say, I love my life, and we want to walk in each other's shoes every day.
Well, I guess you're doing it. Amy and Mark Vachon, authors of Equally Shared Parenting, thanks so much for joining us.
You know, we have some of those challenges at home, my wife and I.
I bet.
We have to talk and talk, and we do have to sometimes keep a tally to make sure that it works out. Tell us your take at 800-543-2543. You can also email us at myticketthetakeaway.org. And if you're reaching out to talk about Senator Harry Reid, you can call us there. What do you think about Harry Reid referring to Obama as a light-skinned African-American?
This is Jill from Austin, Texas, and I do find them offensive. I think it takes away from who the president is, and essentially it says that a black person can't be president or can't be successful unless they look and sound like a white person.
Weigh in on the Harry Reid comment or anything we're talking about on The Takeaway. You can go to thetakeaway.org and take our podcast to go. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The perils of discussing black electability. White-skinned Senator Harry Reid is quoted during the campaign talking about light-skinned Negro candidates.
It's certainly not credible for the Democrats to sit back and go, well, it was in the context of saying something nice. It's an old mindset when you're using language in a 2008 that harkens back to the 1950s and 60s.
A senator goes on the defensive. The Democrats plead no context. Race in the Barack Obama era. As far as the GOP is concerned, there are still some elephants in the room. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, January 11th, and The Takeaway is trying to figure out if there are new rules of engagement for talking about race in the Obama era.
And why we can never get to a substantive conversation about it. And anyway,
we'll give it a
shot. Let's get to the top stories we're following this morning. NATO says six soldiers, including three Americans, have been killed in Afghanistan, marking the deadliest day in 2 months. Here at home, a couple of big, far-reaching trials get underway today. In New York City, it's the first prosecution of a Guantanamo Bay prisoner in a U.S. civilian court. The trial could set precedents affecting the prosecution of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's accused of being the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. And in California, the first federal trial to determine if same-sex marriages are legal under the Constitution gets underway today as well. It's a challenge to Prop 8. That's the gay marriage ban approved by California voters. Earlier, we spoke to Kenji Yoshino, a law professor at New York University, who told us the case against the ban has two main arguments.
The liberty argument says that there's a fundamental right to marry, and the equality argument says that this is discrimination against gay people.
The case is expected to be appealed to the Supreme Court.
Stimulus spending on roads and bridges was supposed to spark local employment, but an Associated Press analysis finds it hasn't really worked. There's been no impact on local employment rates. Meanwhile, President Obama is pushing another stimulus package as a way to accelerate job growth. The Senate is not even in session, and already there's political battling. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is facing some criticism for comments he made about President Obama during the 2008 campaign. He was quoted in a book suggesting that Obama could become the first black president because he was, quote, light-skinned and did not speak with a, quote, Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. But first, Omar Wasso joins us. He's a contributor for an online magazine called The Root. Omar, put us in the mind of a voter in Nevada. Now, Harry Reid is up for re-election there. Does an African-American voter listen to this story, see that remark, and go, I'm less likely to vote for Harry Reid now? Is this something weighted more than other issues like the economy? What do you think?
I don't think black voters are going to put much weight on this at all, John.
And that's because why?
Negro is just not a racist term. It's a dated term, but it doesn't carry the weight. I mean, basically the intention matters, and Harry Reid's intention does not seem to reflect anything that black folks don't experience and know goes on all the time.
So in the Obama era, you can be obsolete, but you can't be hateful. Harry Reid seems to have passed that test for now. Omar Wasso, stay with us. We'll be back to talk about this more in just a moment.
The freakish cold weather continues in Florida. Miami set a record low temperature over the weekend with 35 degrees.
Avatar ruled the box office for the fourth straight weekend. It's now number six on the all-time domestic list with $429 million, with $1.3 billion made worldwide. For the first time ever, there were more cars sold in China than in the United States. More than 13 million cars were sold in China last year, which is a 52% rise from the year before, and that's 3 million more than were sold here in the U.S. Let's take a look at the markets. Asian and European markets are up today. Futures are up, so Wall Street will probably bounce when it gets underway, the trading on Wall Street in about a half hour from now. The Dow starts at 10,618. The S&P opens at 1,144, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,317.
We're going to be talking about the 75th anniversary of Amelia Earhart's flight across the Pacific this hour, but we're also talking about what Harry Reid had to say. How seriously do you take his comment that he made before the election that Barack Obama could become the first black president because of the light color of his skin and the fact that he didn't speak in a quote-unquote Negro dialect? Let us know what you think.
Could have been the number talking today. About Eminem there. right?
Yeah, he could have. Yeah. I think Harry Minem would have a hard time getting elected. 800-543-2543.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. So, a juicy quote for a new book rollout, and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has suddenly some explaining to do. The Democrats are closing ranks, and Republicans sense an issue. First, the specifics. A campaign book called Game Changer, being released this week, quotes the Democratic senator as saying Barack Obama could become the nation's first black president because of his light skin, and that he has no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. Reid apologized for his comments, and President Obama has accepted his apology. But we're wondering this morning if lots of people were having such conversations during the campaign as they were assessing Barack Obama's electability. Nevertheless, Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele believes there's a double standard on race. If a Republican had been caught talking about black electability,
this chairman and this president would be calling for his head. And they would be labeling every Republican in the country as a racist for saying exactly what this chairman has just said.
And Michael Steele said, after all, Senator Trent Lott's head rolled after these comments back in 2002 at a one-time pro-segregationist Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday party. Here's Trent Lott.
When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either.
Trent Lott resigned as Senate Minority Leader after that comment. Well, is there a double standard? Is the comparison even fair? And certainly a lot has happened since 2002. In the year since Barack Obama became president, is it easier or harder to talk openly about race in America? To help us figure out what are the implications of Senator Reid's words and other issues, I think a more general discussion we would hope to have, is Omar Wasso, who's a senior contributor to The Root, and Ta-Nehisi Coates, senior editor for The Atlantic and author of The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and An Unlikely Road to Manhood. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Omar, we talked to you a moment ago. Just what is your general reaction to this whole Reid affair? It seems to me like you're saying, never mind.
Well, I'm saying, actually, that there's good evidence that, that a lighter-skinned candidate is actually preferred by white voters, so Harry Reid is right on that count. Two, that there's a lot of research that suggests people have very negative reactions to black English, and so the fact that then Senator Obama could talk, you know, like white people, which is unsurprising given that he was raised by his white mother, is something that probably is advantageous in an election. And if we take Harry Reid's comment to mean that he's observing, he's not endorsing these facts, he's not saying these are, you know, good, harsh realities about American politics, then it's quite unremarkable. He's sort of stating what is, right, in a lot of ways obvious.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, aside from being opportunistic, why do you think the Republicans sense this is an issue?
I think it reflects a misunderstanding of race and why African Americans over the years have been cool to Republicans. I think the comparison to Trent Lott is instructive. I think this is like when you compare what Harry Reid said to Trent Lott, it's a very surface analysis. So you hear the word Negro and you think, okay, so, you know, we know that black people don't particularly like to be called Negroes in this day and age, so they'll probably be insulted. But I think what's much more important is the actual content of what was said. Trent Lott was expressing pride and endorsing a candidate whose, you know, the majority of his platform was basically segregation. That's the problem. There's no way to restate that in the way Omar just restated, say, what Harry Reid said, right, to make it more acceptable. It's the actual content of what was said.
Well, then does that mean, Ta-Nehisi Coates, that we are possibly living positively in an era where discussions about race are more sophisticated, that simple code words aren't going to throw the alarm bells into high gear, that we can actually have discussions that we possibly weren't able to have comfortably even as recently as 2002?
I don't know, because I think had Harry Reid said that in 2002, I think the reaction among African Americans would have pretty much been the same. African Americans, in terms of things that have really gotten us upset, it's never really been code words. Nappy-headed hoe is not a code word. It's a racial insult. There's no way to spin that to make that
referring to the Don Imus scandal there.
Right, yeah. Right, right. Claiming that you're proud for supporting a segregationist candidate for president, that's not a code word. It's just what he said. There's no, I mean, there's no way to spin that to make that better or make that more honest. I mean, it was what he said.
But Omar, wouldn't it be great if this particular scandal actually sparked a dialogue about why it's more acceptable to have a politician with lighter skin and why it's more acceptable to have a politician who, quote unquote, sounds like a white person, or why we're even talking about a Negro dialect? Wouldn't that be great if that's what this was?
I think it would be great if we were talking more about, you know, the research that says there are these, there is sort of a color-struck quality to our country. But that's not really what's happening generally. I mean, what's you know, the nature of the debate is Harry Reid has had to do a lot of mea culpas about something that is, you know, it's really a mountain out of a molehill. And most of the discussion is much more of a he said kind of gotcha approach. And so I think you're right. There's the potential for a much richer discussion, but I don't think on the whole that's what I see happening.
Well, let's shoot for it
in the press.
Let's shoot for it. For instance, is it more likely? Are we more able to have a discussion of why, say, the two most famous African American politicians in the United States do not come from the slave narrative of American history, Barack Obama and Colin Powell? Are we able to have that discussion of how significant that is, either within the black community or among Americans at large? Ta-Nehisi Coates.
I don't know, but I think that reducing the popularity of Barack Obama, and I don't know that Colin Powell's a politician. I think some people would quibble over whether he was actually a politician. But leaving that aside, I think trying to understand their success strictly through the fact that their descent, their ancestors were not slaves here in America, I think is kind of reductive. I'm not saying it doesn't play any role, but I think I would much more focus on the individual talent or lack of talent among those two people in particular. I think
Omar, your reaction?
Well, you know, one of the interesting debates that came up in the early part of the campaign was Barack black enough? And what I think people missed in those discussions was the long history in the black community of precisely these sorts of, kind of candidates of black leaders having different histories. So whether you're talking about W.E.B. Du Bois, who had Caribbean history, or Malcolm X, who had Caribbean heritage, or both Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington,
right,
who were both half white. I mean, this is nothing new in the black community. And so there's a kind of lack of context and a lack of history that people bring to these discussions when they sort of key in on Obama as being somehow different in this way, as opposed,
right,
to being part of a long tradition.
Well, maybe it's a broader discussion if we're having it this morning. Omar Washoe is contributor to The Root in Boston, Massachusetts, and Ta-Nehisi Coates is senior editor for The Atlantic, talking about the possible elephants in the room regarding race in America. Thanks to both of you.
And now let's check out on stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour. An Associated Press report this morning says the first stimulus package had little impact on local employment. The report comes at a time when President Obama has called for another stimulus plan to keep the economy moving forward. Wall Street banks are due to reveal the size of the bonuses they'll give employees. There's expected to be some hostile public reaction when banks that needed taxpayer support announce big bonus payments. Earlier, we spoke to behavioral economist Dan Ariely.
The reason that the market is doing relatively so well compared to the rest of the economy is because we've injected lots and lots of money.
The man accused of killing Kansas abortion doctor George Tiller goes on trial today. Scott Roeder faces charges of first-degree murder. The judge has ruled the defendant can argue voluntary manslaughter. Record low temperatures continue to grip Florida, breaking record lows set more than 80 years ago. The National Weather Service says overnight temperatures at the Miami airport dipped to 36 degrees, beating the previous low of 37 set in 1927. There's a hard freeze watch on till tomorrow. Much of the rest of the South is also in the grip of that deep freeze. The father of the so-called balloon boy must report today to begin serving a 30-day jail sentence, which will be followed by 60 days of work release. Richard Heaney had pleaded guilty, but has claimed in a recent media blitz that it wasn't a hoax, that he believed his son was on that runaway balloon. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton takes off today on a 10-day trip to strengthen ties in the Pacific, Australia, New Zealand, and Papua New Guinea on the itinerary.
Let's look at some of the stories you're watching this morning. Coming up, we'll talk about unemployment. Have the job losses slowed down, maybe reversed yet? We'll take a look at unemployment in the first 2 weeks of the new year.
Hey, you want that to go?
And at the news takeout counter this morning, we have Dan Gross, senior editor and financial writer from Newsweek, here in the studio. You took an early train from Connecticut, huh, Dan?
It's Monday morning.
It's great to have you here. Also, Ibrahim Abdelmateen, our sports contributor, is also here in the studio. So we got a full studio. Dan, let's talk about the jobs question. Earlier in the program, some analysts were suggesting that the Democrats have to focus completely on jobs if they have any chance in the midterm elections. If you start to focus on jobs in the economy, what do you see?
Well, disappointment in Friday's job report. We lost 84,000 jobs. People were expecting this might be the first month of a turnaround. But actually embedded in that was the revision to the November number, which showed a extremely slim gain of 4,000 jobs, making November 2009 the first month since December 2007. The first in 23 months where payroll jobs were actually added.
And is this a restoration of pre-existing positions that responded to demand in the economy, or are we seeing a shift to a green economy, fundamentally new kinds of jobs that are going to last, the kinds of things that Washington politicians talk about?
Well, there's always a huge amount of churn, jobs being destroyed, jobs being created. There's some evidence that people may be getting recalled to jobs at sort of auto plants. Their first quarter production numbers are going to be much bigger than they were a year ago. But across the economy, aside from this jobs report, there is other evidence that is showing there is less firing and a little more hiring. The Conference Board reported last week that the number of online ads for jobs, which is where classifieds are these days, was up by a couple hundred thousand, by 7% in December. First-time unemployment claims continue to go down. Announced firings down.
Right.
So the trend is turning. In the first quarter of 2009, the economy destroyed 700,000 jobs per month. If we're down to the tens of thousands, that's progress. Not enough, but still progress.
Dan Gross, senior editor and financial writer from Newsweek. Thanks so much.
Now let's go to sports with Ibrahim Abdelmateen. Big weekend for football, Ibrahim. We saw two teams in the NFC go out and get their wild card spots. The New York Jets is all anybody can talk about here. They went into Cincinnati and walloped the Bengals on Saturday. And then the Colts upset the New England Patriots, which is an even bigger surprise. Well, I think it was a bigger surprise. What do you think?
That's funny. It says the Baltimore Colts, but it's actually the Baltimore Ravens, who actually used to be the Baltimore Colts, which is kind of funny. So this is the thing. The Jets are on a run now. And the thing about the playoffs and that everyone needs to understand is that the playoffs represents the teams throughout the season that at some point or one point or another went on a run, whether it was the beginning of the season, the middle, or the end. They went on some kind of run that could bunch together a bunch of wins. Now, the San Diego Chargers, who the Jets are going to have to face after beating, they beat the Cincinnati Bengals 24-14 Saturday, but now they face the San Diego Chargers, who have won 11 games in a row.
Yeah.
That's one of the most solid runs, and that's why starting towards the end of the season, I was starting to think that the San Diego Chargers were the best equipped team to make a run towards the Super Bowl. The New York Jets now, because their coach Rex Ryan believes in them, and he's instilled in them a strong belief that they can do it. The Jets are also a team that everyone has to be afraid of.
Okay, and the upset of the Patriots?
Well,
what
that
happened?
There was something that really, there was like, and New England fans, I know that something was aching inside of them. It was a tough year with the Red Sox this year. It's been difficult.
Yeah.
The Celtics are doing good too, but they're not looking as strong as they've been looking. And then the Patriots have this like collapse, this demise, and Tom Brady is throwing horrible passes and their defense just doesn't
You're
seem like it's
feeling sorry for people in Boston.
You know what? It's not that I feel sorry for them, but I know that they're hurting.
He's empathy.
Exactly.
He's empathy.
There we go. That's what it is.
Detroit.
Now there's some.
We love Detroit.
Yeah, absolutely.
We love Detroit.
Thanks so much, sports contributor Ibrahim Abdelmateen.
Thank you. Good morning.
Our last takeout comes from you, listeners. With airline security still kind of up in the air, we've been hearing from you on how to make it better. Leah says, nobody is talking about the most vulnerable area of airline travel, the people who clean the planes and baggage handlers, etc. They aren't very highly paid. Many are immigrants with family ties in other countries. What is to stop Al-Qaeda from bribing them with money to take something onto the plane and hide it for a potential bomber to pick up? Well,
nothing is to stop that, actually. Well, Alan, Oklahoma.
We don't want to trash all of the airline support personnel.
Yeah, that's true.
That's
it. Right. Al in Oklahoma City emails us, like it or not, profiling is a useful tool, one of many in law enforcement and security procedures. It involves much more than just race or religion. Demeanor and answers to questioning and observation are indicators that profiling adds to the mix to assess potential threats. All these should be used to assure transportation safety.
One listener had a thought after being annoyed with all of our coverage. This is an anonymous listener. After what I thought was your overextended coverage of the Christmas foiled terror incident, I came up with a new six-word slogan for the coming year. Life is dangerous. Get over it.
And finally today, if you want to weigh in, we have a different phone line just for today. While Alex is down, you can reach us at 800-543-2543. We just talked about Senator Harry Reid's comments about Barack Obama and whether or not they were racist. What do you think?
Hi, my name is Lorenzo, calling from Jersey City. I think his comments was on point. I'm African-American. I believe that when it comes down to dark-skinned African-American, there's a double standard. I think most light-skinned African-American is well accepted by white society. Honestly, it's the truth coming from an African-American. It's the truth.
Ibrahim, I got to ask you. First of all, let me just give you the phone number today because it's changed. 800-543-2543. What do you think, Ibrahim?
Well, I think there's always truth in some of these things, but I think some of it gets inflated beyond. And maybe Herod Reed might be right, like this guy's saying, but maybe Herod Reed isn't quite the right messenger for that message.
But, you know, the one thing that we were saying in the earlier discussion is that a lot of people were having these kinds of conversations, trying to imagine, all right, under what circumstances could Barack Obama be elected, and what is it about him that might get him elected? Is it an inappropriate conversation to have?
I think there's also the piece that his family's part immigrant, I think, and that gives him a different sensibility. So African-Americans, you know, we're like, well, is he really one of us? That whole conversation that was early in the election.
Yeah.
So it brings up a lot of the race conversations that we've been having for a long time.
Weigh in at 800-543-2543 or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to visit the North American Auto Show.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we're going to travel to Detroit for the North American Auto Show and the future of cars. Are they headed towards electric cars? Or maybe they're heading towards hybrid cars? How are we going to make our cars greener? Find out in a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories you're following at 30 minutes after the hour. It's been the deadliest day for U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan in 2 months. NATO says 6 soldiers, including 3 Americans, have been killed in the fighting. That raises the number of U.S. military deaths to 10 so far this year as the surge gets underway. We're also learning more about the opinions and attitudes of Afghans toward the war. A BBC-ABC news poll out this morning shows nearly 7 in 10 Afghans support the presence of U.S. forces in their country. Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, the BBC's Rob Watson told us more.
There's a lot more support for President Karzai. Support for the Taliban has absolutely plummeted, and there's a real softening, a real brightening of attitudes towards U.S. and other foreign forces being there.
Support for U.S. and NATO forces drops sharply in the south and east, where the fighting is most intense.
Congress gets back to work this week with the White House pushing for another round of stimulus to boost the economy. But an Associated Press report this morning says spending on roads and bridges under the current stimulus plan has had no effect on local employment. The White House is planning to announce funding for 9 projects to increase fuel efficiency of cars and trucks. A company in Indiana will get $40 million to develop a more efficient and cleaner diesel engine. For the first time ever, more cars were sold in China than in the United States by 13 million. That was the difference. Let's check the markets. The Dow is up this morning, as expected, about 34 points. The NASDAQ is up about 9 points, and the S&P, right at the early going, is up about 5. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Okay, John, take a listen to this. Are you a car guy? Is that the kind of thing that kind of make your heart race? Listening.
Hearing vroom vrooms and stuff.
Yeah. The racing, huge, powerful engine.
It's cool. I like it.
He has a turbocharged 2-liter engine with 370 horsepower, and the whole body is made out of aluminum.
Big deal. My whole hot rod body is made out of fiberglass, and we all know how fast fiber makes you move.
That, of course, Tim Allen, the ultimate car guy. He was actually from Detroit. But the days of revving engines and multi-cylinder vehicles could be coming to an end. Automakers are turning their focus to greener vehicles. Could be
no more fuel dragsters? No more?
Could be the end of the V6 engine as a major standard platform. We're joined now by Eddie Alterman. He's the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver, based in Detroit, and Jim Motivelli, a car blogger for the New York Times and author of Forward Drive, The Race to Build Clean Cars for the Future. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Eddie, set the scene for us in Detroit. The auto show is going on right now, or at least the press preview of it. Can you tell me, is there an indication of this greener push that you could actually see?
There's a tremendous amount of hype around green vehicles and so-called EVs or electric vehicles. But I'd say don't write the obituary for the V8 engine just yet.
No?
No. Product planners in the car business work at about, a 7 or 8 year cycle, and they're working down the road. And they're not going to schedule an engine for a vehicle that doesn't exist yet. And electric power is just not there yet.
Well, is this all big high? I mean, inside the Detroit Auto Show, there's a big electric avenue about electric cars. There's the forest in the basement of the
right.
Auto Show. Is that all just marketing?
Well, a little bit, yeah. I mean, the range on these vehicles is no greater than 60 miles when you're using it. And so I think there's something called range anxiety when you've got the vehicle on the highway and you're running out of electricity. Where do you go? What do you do?
So, Jim, what do you think? Do you think this is all just hype, or is this a real push toward greener cars from the auto industry?
Oh, I think it's a very real push, and we're going to see some of the first fruits of that. We're going to see the Chevy Volt this year. We're going to see the Nissan Leaf, which is a battery car. We're going to see cars from new startup companies like Coda. And I would say that Eddie is being a little pessimistic about the range of electric cars. Quite a lot of them have a range of 100 miles or more, including the Leaf. And I think GM last night. All the auto companies are very sincere about going green. We're going to see at the auto show the introduction of some new hybrid cars that are very exciting, including from Toyota and from Honda. And hybrid and electrics and all variations of that, I think, are the wave of the future. I think there's evidence that the consumer has voted with his feet away from V6 engines and larger power plants. And, yes, it takes a long time to develop auto drivetrains, but I think the clear move is towards electric cars and certainly more electrically aided transportation. I don't think you will see a automaker at the Detroit show that is not showing some form of electrically aided transportation, whether it's a hybrid or a battery electric. And I think that's clearly the wave of the future. Yes, there is range anxiety. I would agree with that. But I think if people actually own these cars, that's going to fade.
But Jim, put this in perspective for us. The V6 was the more efficient, less gas-guzzling version of the V8. If we're seeing the end of the V6 as the standard platform, how big of a change is this? What kind of sea change is this?
Well, I think you can over-exaggerate the importance of that. I think companies are getting pretty much the same amount of horsepower out of four-cylinder engines that have been either turbocharged or supercharged, or they've gotten a lot more efficient with smaller displacements, and therefore the V6 isn't really needed. And you can get much greater fuel efficiency out of smaller engines, and I think consumers are caring about that. If you look at some of the most popular models like the Honda Accord or the Chevy Malibu, most buyers are buying the four-cylinder even though a V6 is offered. So as the Detroit News put it, it's beginning a long fade into history, the V6. And, the V8 has already basically done that.
Eddie, let's talk a little bit about the big strategic changes. Aren't a lot of these technologies dependent on Americans stepping back from the personal transportation model and maybe taking more of the shopping cart model for transportation?
Yeah.
A car that I used. Any evidence that that's going on at this show?
Well, they'd like, I think, people to think that. But here's the hypocrisy in our energy policy, and I think this is the larger issue. The government is telling us and putting all kinds of stimulus money behind battery development, and then sort of out of the other side of their mouth, they're saying, well, we got to keep gas cheap. And as long as gas is $2 a gallon or $3, I mean, I think we saw the threshold two summers ago at $4 a gallon. Until it gets that high, there's really no impetus for anybody to do anything about it. So you have this, you're sort of caught in this bind where there is a tremendous push on the part of the government to get this technology up and running, but they're also kind of contradicting themselves in terms of their energy policy.
Okay, so I'm just going to ask you both quickly to answer me. Who do you think is going to win this race? Is it going to be the hybrid car, the hydrogen fuel cell car, the electric car? Which one?
It's going to be a mix of technologies until something really develops on its own and really gets strong enough to have one powertrain in the car,
okay,
as opposed to a hybrid.
Eddie, editor-in-chief of Car and Driver.
I would say that the electric car is the ultimate winner. I think it's winning out over hydrogen. I think it will ultimately win over internal combustion. Though, as Eddie says, it takes a long time for that to happen. There's a long lead time with autos, but I do think we're going on down the electric road.
We'll see what happens. That's Jim Motovalli, blogger for the New York Times car blog Wheels and author of Forward Drive, The Race to Build Clean Cars for the Future, and Eddie Alterman, editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and this may be the biggest story of the week. The fight for gay marriage picks up in California today with Perry v. Schwarzenegger. Two same-sex couples are suing the enforcers of Proposition 8 in federal court on grounds that the gay marriage ban violates their constitutional rights. It might lay the groundwork for a Supreme Court appeal, and many gay rights advocates argue that the nation isn't ready for that, but this is possibly a landmark case. Joining us to discuss it is Kenji Yoshino, New York University law professor. Good morning, Kenji.
Good morning.
So what is the doctrine that the lawyers arguing that the Proposition 8 is unconstitutional are likely to argue in open court today?
The two main arguments are a liberty argument and an equality argument. So the liberty argument says that there's a fundamental right to marry, and the equality argument says that this is discrimination against gay people.
Now, I'm presuming that on the other side, the fact that there's no mention of the status of marriage anywhere in the Constitution would be central to, at least in part, the case on the opposing side.
I think that's right, but I don't want to overstate that too much because the doctrine surrounding this issue has stated pretty clearly that there is a fundamental right to marry. So as you know, there are unenumerated rights that still have a constitutional dimension, like the right to privacy or the right to reproductive autonomy in this country. And so marriage has been deemed one of those rights.
How will the court weigh the value of marriage versus the value of civil unions? And that is marriage a set of benefits or is marriage a state of mind that the state cannot regulate?
That's a great question. I think that actually goes to the equality issue as to what exactly the inequality is. So essentially what we have is with respect to goods or benefits, you know, same-sex couples are being treated equally. So what we're really talking about is a symbolic benefit of marriage and whether or not withholding that symbolic benefit from gay couples is in itself an equal protection violation.
Now, some gay rights advocates are concerned that if this case should go against Proposition 8, that you create a kind of Roe v. Wade situation where American politics could be polarized for generations on the issue of gay marriage, and that that could complicate the rights of gay people in the United States.
That's right. I mean, that's actually a very optimistic worry to have, because if we actually get a Supreme Court decision in our favor, that means that the Roe versus Wade analogy would work. I think the more likely outcome and the greater fear is that we'll get an outcome against us, and then we'll have something akin to Bowers versus Hardwick, which was a negative anti-gay opinion that we had a really hard time getting off the books for, you know, 17 years until Lawrence versus Texas in 2003. So both of those fears are on the table.
On what basis would the Supreme Court take this case? Its interest in resolving states' rights issues or on the merits of the rights of gay couples alone?
Well, I think that the Supreme Court would take it on the grounds that it was argued on both liberty and equality grounds, but there are actually two ways in which we could keep this away from the Supreme Court. One is to say that it's California-specific on the grounds of the animus behind Prop 8, and then the other one is that it's California-specific because 18,000 couples got married in a very narrow window of time, and so California is the only state in which some same-sex couples are married and other couples are not.
Well, it'll all be in open court this week as Perry v. Schwarzenegger convenes in a court in San Francisco. Kenji Yoshino is New York University law professor, talking about the Prop 8 case, which may challenge the ban on gay marriage in the state of California, which could be headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Thank you, Kenji.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. 75 years ago, Amelia Earhart flew solo across the Pacific. But getting gender equality in aviation is an even bigger distance than that. We're going to talk with a modern pioneer in just a moment. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Democratic leaders are back to working this morning on a final health care bill. They're still split on how to pay for it. Meanwhile, President Obama is meeting with labor leaders who are angry with his support of a tax on high-end insurance plans rather than on a tax on millionaires. We'll find out today how big the bonuses will be for Wall Street bankers. Former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, speaking earlier on CBS, said large bonuses are unacceptable in these times.
This is inequitable, it is wrong, it is aberrant, and it's creating a crisis.
Goldman Sachs is expected to pay its employees an average of nearly $600,000.
You need to get a drink of water.
It's just killing
choking
me.
You
it's
up.
Killing.
Absolutely. The Supreme Court is expected to weigh in on campaign finance issues this week. It could potentially allow businesses, unions, and wealthy individuals to pay for campaign ads. Current federal law bans businesses and interest groups from funding election ads. The South remains in the grip of a deep freeze. Overnight temperatures in Miami dipped to 36 degrees, beating the previous low of 37. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
When the history of our times is written, it must record as supremely significant the physical, psychic, and social changes women have undergone in these exciting decades.
Amelia Earhart was speaking in the exciting decade of the mid-1930s, delivering a speech about women and science. Today marks the 75th anniversary of Earhart's successful flight from Honolulu to Oakland, California. She was the first woman to fly solo across the Pacific. The culture of the airplane cockpit we think of as male in this 21st century, but the image of the swashbuckling woman, Amelia Earhart, seems more remote than the 75 years since she made that solo flight and then some years later was lost at sea. To talk about why, though, that seems so remote, we have a real pioneer with us this morning. Major Nicole Malachowski is a senior pilot in the Air Force and just 5 years ago became the first woman to become part of the elite Thunderbird squad, also known as the Air Force Aerial Demonstration Squadron. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Major, good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. You don't have to call me sir. do you see yourself in very much the tradition of Amelia Earhart? And when were you, did you first encounter her story growing up?
Well, I certainly hold the story of Amelia Earhart and all she accomplished in high esteem. And it's very difficult to think of myself in that same light. I decided I wanted to be an Air Force fighter pilot when I was 5 years old, and that's when I began my research into aviation and certainly the portion of women in aviation, Amelia Earhart being a big part of that. I remember coming to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum when I was 12 years old and seeing the huge display on Amelia Earhart and her aircraft actually in there. And it really brought history to life, and it made me realize that, you know, my dream of becoming an Air Force fighter pilot, which I had as a young child, was something that was possible. And so I'm just proud to be part of the continuum of women in aviation.
You know, I was researching this and reading a little bit in advance of talking to you, and it seems to me that something changed, that the Amelia Earhart, the sort of woman swashbuckler adventurer, was a more familiar image, 50, 60, 70 years ago than it is now. What do you think changed in the generation of the, say, post-World War II era that made aviation much more a male kind of test pilot culture?
Well, I mean, I can see how you can look at it that way. I take it differently, having maybe researched a little bit more history or being closer to the women in aviation. As you may know, there were a lot of women who flew aircraft during World War II. They didn't fly in combat, but they were called the Women Air Force Service Pilots. And I think really with the flying of women during World War II, those WASP, Women Air Force Service Pilots, right. That was really the beginning of women in military aviation. And from that time in World War II, we started seeing advances. You know, when I was born in 1974, at that time there weren't any women that were allowed into pilot training. That wouldn't happen until 1979. So in the context of my lifetime, I think it's been a little bit more normal, or something that I've been very aware of, that there were women making inroads in aviation. So at the time of Amelia Earhart, it may have just been a cultural thing at the time where, you know, women weren't as well integrated, obviously, into flying. Remember, she wasn't the first woman to fly an aircraft by any means. She just became very, very famous for her exploits and for her accomplishments. But at the same time, women have been flying since before, you know, Amelia Earhart, all the way up until now. So for me, in the context of my lifetime, I've always been very aware of the women who've been making the inroads for me and blazing trails before me.
What did it take for you to become a Thunderbird?
Well, in order to be a Thunderbird, you have to have, at the time I applied, a minimum of 1,000 hours as a fighter pilot or in fighter aircraft. And if you put that in the context of when women were allowed to start flying fighters, which was 1993, it takes you some time. Yeah, that's when the Congress lifted the ban on women in combat aviation. I happened to be a sophomore at the Air Force Academy at the time, so my timing was perfect. It takes some time to garner that 1,000 hours to be able to apply, and as soon as I gained 1,000 hours as a fighter pilot in the F-15E, I went ahead and applied to the team, just like anybody else, male or female.
And were men
Were
men in the Air Force helpers of your career, or were they competitors, and did you have to pit yourself against virtually all the men in the Air Force?
Helpers. I would not be where I am today and have had the opportunities or the successes that the Air Force has afforded me without my teammates, both male and female. Remember, I was one of the first women to start flying fighters for our country. That means that all of my wingmen, all of my instructors, hands down in fighter community, have been male. And if it wasn't for their positive support and their ability to treat me, you know, equally and fairly, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Amelia Earhart said back in the 30s that while still greatly unnumbered, women are finding more and more opportunities for employment, and I hope this movement will spread throughout all branches and that women will come to share with men the joy of flying. Do you think that dream has come true in your lifetime?
I think that dream has come true in my lifetime. I live it. I'm a part of a wonderful organization like the Air Force, United States Military, where there are dozens of women who are out there sharing the dream of flying fighter aircraft, and hundreds of women that are flying in our transport and our cargo aircraft all around the world, including in combat operations. So for me, and within the Air Force, it's really operations as normal.
And Nicole Malachowski, your favorite maneuver in one of those fighter jets that you fly for the Thunderbirds?
Oh, okay, well, flying on the Thunderbirds, I'd have to say probably the end maneuver, the bomb burst maneuver, where we all cross at the very end, 90 degrees out from each other. It's a lot of closure, a lot of velocity, a lot of things happen quickly. And if we can, when we would nail it and get it 100%, it was a beautiful thing.
And I'm sure I might lose my breakfast if I were there in the cockpit with you, Nicole Malachowski. She's a senior pilot in the Air Force who just 5 years ago became the first woman Thunderbird, a member of the Air Force Aerial Demonstration Squadron. Joining us on this 75th anniversary of Amelia Earhart's successful solo Pacific flight. And we should note, current estimates are of the 80,000 airline pilots worldwide, 4,000 are women.
If you want to weigh in on anything at all, you can reach us at today at 1-800-543-2543 or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We have been getting a lot of comments about Senator Harry Reid's comments. He reportedly said before the election that Obama could become the nation's first black president because of his light skin and because he has no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. John, let's turn this conversation over to the listeners.
Hi, I'm Sheila calling from Texas. I don't believe it's because of him being light-skinned, because the truth of the matter is that he's still black, and everybody saw that when he was being elected. I do believe it's because he's well-spoken and he sounds very polished. That contributed to it, but for the sake of his, you know, color, I don't think it really made a difference.
My name is Ryan. I'm calling from New Jersey, and I think that the supposed controversy about Harry Reid's comments are absolutely preposterous. The senator simply stated two facts that any rational individual could ascertain for themselves.
My name is Dr. Diamond. Mr. Reid was right on target, and white people just don't want to acknowledge it. I don't think his comment was racist. I think that he spoke what most white people do when you go in for a job. They look at your color and your dialect, so he was correct.
My name is Armstead Christian. I'm an associate professor at Berklee College of Music and involved in diversity training. I would love to have Mr. Reed's attention and spend some time with him on dealing with sensitivity issues. Although the statement was not racist in nature, it was insensitive and very presumptuous on his part. That just shows that we have not gone that far into the antiquated concepts that some still hold.
This is Ann, and I'm in Michigan. The Republicans, many of them, or their talking heads, have said a lot worse things about Obama, both while he was running and after he was elected. And I just can't believe that they're now making an issue of this.
1-800-543-2543 or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Senator Reid stepped on the third rail there, that's for sure. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.